notorious format breaker that I am, I wanted to let, Charles is okay with this because we're going to spend some time together tonight. Wanted to hear from David in Toronto, and you might want to hear this too. David, come on up on the bridge of the mothership, which is Coast to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Ideal in fact, not speculation.
Thank you.
The Occupy people, you have their hearts in the right place, but the leadership has prepared for this. Back in 2008, George Bush signed an agreement with the Canadian government. In the event of civil unrest in the U.S., the Canadian military is authorized to come down to the U.S. and beat up on U.S. citizens. Don't take my word for it, listeners. Go to your computers and Google U.S., Canada, military, mutual military assistance, and watch all the Canadian papers pop up. It was news all over Canada. It was quiet in the U.S., but they're ready for this. They will, are determined there will be no Arab Spring in the U.S. They're going to beat the people down like you would not believe.
So we're going to see those heat rays and everything else if this escalates much further. I've been wondering where they are.
Or you're going to see Canadian military troops in U.S. cities with their guns pointed at U.S. citizens. Don't take my word for it. Go Google it yourself. It's in all the Canadian papers.
Well, I'll tell you what. I love the Canadian people, but I'll tell you this. You pull that down in Texas and you'll only do it once. Thank you very much for calling, David. You know, I don't fancy myself some sort of a brave man, but I'll tell you this. I don't fancy myself a coward either. We're going to come back and talk with Charles R. Smith. This is a connected man, and he's a friend of Coast. He's been on many times. First time I've ever spoken with him, and I really look forward to it. So hang in there for a minute. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. John Wells in with you tonight. Charles R. Smith, I am looking at your biography here, and I cannot believe all the stuff that you have done. From a top-secret clearance as a top-level computer engineer for EDS, which was not the easiest company to get a gig with, war games programs used by the Army as well as the Naval Weapons Center in Virginia and North American Rockwell, and on and on and on. Welcome. It's going to be great talking to you tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
I don't know where to start. This is a...
Well, you know, a lot of that dates back to the old Cold War days when life was simple and it was just us and them and we can blow up the world in 25 minutes. You know, today
sure, even had a flag we could drape over the coffin of the enemy, right?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting days, definitely, when you could do things for the military and they would look at you like, you're not supposed to know about that.
Right.
You know, these days it's, we never knew about that to begin with. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun back in those days, doing things like setting up global networks. And then the contractors that set up the network would set up a encrypted email system so we could keep track of each other and arrange times that we could sit down and have drinks. And that was kind of funny because I was sitting there, I'd put that together for the company, and one of the generals at our base walked by and late at night and looked over my shoulder and goes, what's that? And I'm like, well, you know, it's a secure email that I set up on the, in the logistics network. And he was like, whoa, how does it work? You know, and at that point, none of the big brass were using their computers or anything, and all of a sudden, every last one of them, within a week, were just tippy-tapping away. You know, and they were just enthralled with using this, and it was a global thing, and they could just send secure messages that don't even go over radio or anything. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, yeah, it's encrypted. How do you know about that? Well, gee. You know, we didn't really want you guys to read our mail.
Understood. You know what? I've got a list of questions here to ask you, but I've got to jump off into something really quick, and you can help me to let us steer each other into, you know, into the rabbit hole and beyond. You know, I can't help but notice just you hear something and then some time goes by and then you hear something else. And one of the things I was picking up on was something on the Discovery Channel recently was about the SR-71 Blackbird. The guy on there, I don't know how this got past the editors because it doesn't sound that good to me, but maybe there's a simple explanation for it. He said that back in the day when they knew they were going to need a lot of titanium, So the CIA got together with the Russians and arranged for it. You know, and then recently a fellow who named he's too close, so I won't mention who he worked for, but he was over in Russia talking with them, and one of the Russians said, "Come in this room," and he said, "See," and it was a device for reading things. We'll just leave it at that. He said, "Basically, you cannot deny us the technology. We will find, we will acquire, we have, we will help each other, we will do deal." So, how much crossover is there between us and the other side? Because it sure seems like a lot of the Russian stuff that I've seen, the aircraft and so forth, it sure looks like our stuff, you know? And there just seems to be a kind of a parallel cooperative initiative between the East and West. Am I way off the road?
You're not that far off. Actually, you know, the industry globally is a relatively small knit group. They know each other. In some cases, have met each other personally at these symposiums and things. Physics and science being what it is, you can classify as much as you like, but people still are able to figure things out. But it's a good example of cooperation, or weird cooperation, if you want to put it. Now, up on my website, softwar.net, is a whole section of documents on a missile called the Sunburn. That's the NATO code name. It's a supersonic cruise missile, ramjet, designed to destroy aircraft carriers. And at one point during the 1990s, our respective governments were so close. There's a letter there from an American admiral to the top admiral, the commander of the Russian Navy, requesting that we get to purchase some Sunburns so we can test them out. And, you know, that's kind of crazy, but it is true. We do, in many cases, there's a back channel of things where sharing of technology becomes incredibly strange. This whole story revolving around the Sunburn and supersonic ramjet systems carried off later into us purchasing a whole section of missiles, much smaller ramjet systems from the Russians called the Griffin, better known as the Krypton in NATO vernacular. And we found in our testing that there were some flaws in that missile. And our contractor got together with the Russian contractor to correct those flaws so that we could successfully test fire them. And, of course, one of the flaws was, you know, if in an emergency situation you had to jettison the missile from an aircraft, it would either not jettison or it would go off and obviously destroy the aircraft. And that's something that, you know, the Russians would like to know, seeing as how they use it operationally.
Right.
So we helped them improve the missile. We made suggestions on improving its flight characteristics and switching the fuel to give it better range. This was McDonnell Douglas back before it became part of Boeing. That, you know, again, there's a whole section of documents that are up on my website. All this stuff was obtained by the Freedom of Information Act, which is another form of information warfare.
Right.
And it's an amazing tale of us visiting their military infrastructure and making purchases and bringing the stuff back over here. And then sharing many of the things that we discovered from their systems back with them. And, of course, the Krypton eventually became a best-selling product by the Russians. They've since sold the design to the Chinese, and they've also sold it to the Indians and several other countries. So,
you know, I can see how a case could be made for this actually keeping tensions a little bit lower. It's like, if we have something that's just so much more advanced than what they have, it's like, this generates suspicion. Now we must ramp up efforts to find out what you have so that we can surpass it, almost like a road rage thing where the participants have to out-fierce each other. Do you agree with that? Does it keep things stable?
No, I really don't, actually. I asked a rather highly placed engineer that I know in Lockheed what the heck was going on when I read that Lockheed was hosting Chinese generals at Edwards Air Force Base during a luncheon party. And his response was, quote, grow your own threat. Right. In order to go to Congress and say we need the next generation of systems, you got to have a threat to beat them over the head with. So you grow your own threat. You take your current technology and you sell it at a profit, basically through the back channels, to your adversaries who build their own, and then you can come forward to Congress and say, we need that multi-billion dollar project in order to counter this brand new stuff that's coming offline. You ever wonder how come the Fulcrum, the SU-27, looks an awful lot like the F-15 Eagle these days?
All their stuff looks like ours. Even that shuttle they built, our shuttle was originally named the Dinosaur, S-O-A-R, and they built one that looks just like it.
Well, Buran was unique. It still had its own Russian characteristics. A lot of that was stolen. Some of it was freely available. Some of it was people coming over and visiting and taking pictures and, you know, talking to folks. But, you know, you got to flip that around. There are times where information warfare and spies are very unsuccessful, and the checkbook works just great. I have some real wonderful pictures of us testing the Russian-designed Styx cruise missile, which were obtained by back channels from North Korea, which now manufactures them. So, sure, we buy their stuff and check it out, and sometimes they buy our stuff and check it out, which is also one of the reasons why in many cases, we don't want to sell our stuff to our friends around the world who eventually peddle it off to other nations. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say the Israeli military, who's been wanting to get their hands on F-22, and the U.S. Air Force, along with many other people who say, we're never exporting this. So, you know, we have seen, in many cases, our technology actually turn around and bite us. We've bombed, for example, the Tiger Song air defense system that was installed in the Iraqi desert by Huawei, which is the Chinese cell phone provider that's been trying to make inroads here. All of that was stolen U.S. technology. They purchased it here during the 1990s. They carried it over, converted it in an air defense system, and resold it. It became known as Tiger Song. That's the NATO code name. And Saddam Hussein purchased it, and we had to find a way to get around it. In fact, that was one of my better hunting stories, because nobody really knew that Saddam Hussein had obtained it until I ran across a bunch of documents showing the Chinese companies that were involved in purchasing it from us here. It's a fiber optic network system. And the Chinese converted it into an integrated air defense. We didn't know that Saddam Hussein had it until I ran into the documentation that said that Chinese were working with the Iraqis. I slipped that to a few people in the Pentagon, and they wrote back that they had to change the flight routes of several U-2s after that, because they suddenly realized they were being tracked and could have been shot down. Basically, it delinked radars from missile sites. You could network the whole thing together, use all the radars on the network, every type of radar. A radar normally associated, say, with an anti-aircraft gun could be used to target a missile from the other side of the country, as long as you're plugged into the network. And they had no idea it was in the desert until they figured it out through the documentation and started looking for it. We had to bomb the heck out of it in order to degrade it enough to be effective against Saddam Hussein. And the variant of it also appeared in the hands of the Taliban. So that's our Chinese pals doing
this. Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry, I just have to just jump in here. Back in the day, and for a long time, I allowed myself to be led to believe that the Chinese and the Russians weren't on that great of terms. What is the situation with their relationship? Are they just, I mean, has there been sort of an ongoing animosity between those two countries?
There is a growing animosity, and partially because the Chinese are doing to the Russians what they've already done to us. They'll purchase weapon systems with the promise of buying billions more and then suddenly clone it. They've done that with the Su-27 Flanker. They have done it with the navalized version of the Flanker. They have the J-11 and the J-15. The Russians are extremely upset because that means now the Chinese not only don't need to buy the billions more of aircraft that they promised, but they can also peddle it on the open market in competition, not paying any license fees. And that's just one example of many different types of equipment. And that's really irritated the Russians to the point now where, in many cases, they're not as cooperative with them as they used to be. There is still an ongoing cooperation, but in many cases, there is now, there's worse than a mutual suspicion. There are some armed patrols on both sides of the border that have come very close to shooting at each other. And in part, one of the reasons for that is the Chinese view a good portion of Siberia as the former Manchurian area that was swallowed up by Stalin at the very end of the war and became Russian territory. They still claim those people as well as the territory as being wholly Chinese, and they make it very clear they want it back. And the Russians are like, no, we're not going to do that. So there is a natural animosity with that large border and the crossing that has occurred. But in recent years, like I said, that the biggest rub between the two has been the fact that the Chinese are cloning much of their technology and then reselling it on the open market in competition with the Russians.
Let me ask you something. This question has been dogging me for a long time, and I ask everybody I can who'll hear the question. Why is it okay for us to do so much business with the Red Chinese? That was Mao's picture over the door to the Olympic Arena and all of that. I mean, what is this?
Well, this is one of those interesting little twists. If you actually look at the Chinese, they're not communists anymore. They're fascists. They're actually parallel in design of their structure, their government, and their economic system to the National Socialist movements of the 30s in Germany and Italy. The basic point being is that capitalism is a good thing as long as it's capitalism that's within the boundaries of the state. And that's the reason why we see Chinese billionaires and major Chinese arms companies owned by the Chinese military coming over here and making their purchases as well as selling us large numbers of very cheap goods because they have the labor. And therein lies the point. Why are we doing this? The answer is the money. You can use any geopolitical excuse you like, but in my experience is it was hard, cold cash that made the difference every time. And I'm not really all that happy about it. In many cases, I've fought against it simply because the guys that I ran into, although masquerading themselves as civilians, turned out to be quite military.
Perfect. So in the end, it's all about the Benjamin Still, or whatever they put on a $1 trillion bill. We're talking tonight with Charles Smith, and we're going to come back and find out about this virus that's attacked our drone fleet et al. Is that applicable? John B. Wells in with you tonight. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks, Ross. Yeah, making sparks for the pyro jock. Okay, the drone virus. It got in there, and now it's It's databasing keystrokes, Facebook orchestration, Twitter too, the Arab Spring, your BlackBerry, databasing of everything you do, aided and abetted by the mobile phone and the computer manufacturers, at the behest of whom, I think we know. It's interesting, isn't it? And this is just a drum. I'm just going to keep on beating it until everybody's put wise to it, as many as possible. There's a lot of email coming in here. You can email me at johnb@coasttocoastam.com. I'm reading them. And, you know, the important thing is that everybody's thinking about it. By the way, the stock market's open on Monday, but the banks and the post office are closed. So let's see if Anonymous manages to crash the market. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more with Charles Smith when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Very interesting emails from all over the place saying our radios are cutting out every once in a while on this. I wonder why that is. Oh, well, must be some atmosphere. Maybe it's HARP. Charles Smith, what about that drone virus that's measuring keystrokes and all that stuff? Or recording them, rather, not measuring them, but recording them.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that are floating around both in the air and in space. I wasn't sure for a while there whether you meant the attack on our drones using the insecure backdoors that have been known vulnerabilities, or their capability of being able to reach in from great distances and monitor what the heck you're doing.
Who's doing the monitoring? Has any information been released, or can any information be released as to who's doing the virus insertion?
The most likely candidate for that would be the, it would most likely have started out with the big Safari team in the U.S. Air Force and has probably spread into some of the other intelligence agencies such as the CIA and the NSA, who are specializing in communications intercepts. Of course, there are, you know, the NRO has a big role. They use their satellites to do a lot of the very same kinds of things as well. I think all of this really wraps around towards a very innovative radar system that was developed recently called the AESA, or Advanced Electronic Scanned Array. And they are quite capable of being used as information warfare assets, as well as just regular radars. They have a bunch of different capabilities. Again, this is part of that advanced technology that we've just kind of stumbled across. Instead of one radar emitter with a great big dish, you can make extremely powerful, very small emitters and place them on a flat plane, like a square or a rectangle or oval, and now you have an array of these things. Instead of just one, you've got thousands, and you can spread the beams, you can focus the beams, you can even manipulate them to receive and send things that could reach into networks, into regular unshielded computer systems, missiles, anything, and literally monitor what's going on, as well as insert viruses and virus code. The F-22 is equipped with the AESA radar. The proposed new E-8 electronic aircraft, Predators, have been equipped with these systems. There are probably several classified aircraft, no doubt very stealthy, that are also equipped with them. The F-18. The EA F-18 Growler is an AESA radar, as well as the F-18, the newest version. And these radars can be used, again, as I pointed out, they don't have to be connected to your computer. They don't have to come down the wire over the Internet. Your computer can actually be sitting standalone right there on your desk with no wires, no wireless stuff attached to it. Yet from remote, I can read your screen, I can watch your keystrokes, I can check your hard drive from hundreds of miles away. I can even do things like insert viruses and activate them when necessary.
And so one more time, who's the likeliest candidate for having done this to our...
Well, the initial development probably came out of Big Safari. Big Safari is an Air Force, that's a code name for an Air Force unit.
Gotcha.
That developed the SUDR program. They got a hold of AESA radars and suddenly discovered they could do some really neat things with them when they started hooking them up to computer algorithms. And if you have an unshielded system, and I mean just a regular bare wire or attachment, you don't have a Faraday cage around your computer, they can do some funny things. And they've also been able to do stuff like disable missiles in flight. They have been able to reach into computer networks and shut them down. They've shut down a power generator, even destroyed a power generator by inserting source code into the computer controls.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and these generally have been operating at distances between 60 and 100 miles because they're using relatively small AESA systems, probably no more than a square meter in size, about a yard, square yard in size. The flip to that is, of course, you know, like the E-8 proposal, you're looking at a plane or array that's probably going to be about 30 or 40 feet in size. So, you know, you'll be able to reach out quite a distance. And, you know, there are, again, things you can do. You can narrow the beam and use it literally like a microwave beam weapon and destroy electronics. And at the same time, you can also hook it up to a computer and do things like monitor communications, as well as literally reach into a computer, insert code, watch what's going on, activate the code. You can do this through active nodes, like, say, wireless nodes that are already set up. Or you can do it, in many cases, as they've demonstrated, completely through unshielded areas. So a lot of that off-the-shelf commercial technology that has been picked up in, by certain countries for use in their defense networks is also very vulnerable to this. It was actually developed more or less as a response to Tiger Song, which is what I stumbled across, like I said, in the late 1990s. Instead of having a big wired network, it's kind of like an internet designed for missiles. And there are no radar, there's no radio emissions between the sites communicating. And that makes it very, very difficult to track and to discern what's going on, because all you have to do is just move to another fiber optic node, plug in, and you're plugged into the network, and your missile can be controlled by a radar on the other side of the country.
Understood.
So, on the other hand, if we have an airplane that can fly a couple hundred miles away that can reach into an unshielded bandwidth and into that node, now I'm in your network. I can insert false targets. I can monitor what's going on. I can insert code into your system that essentially will time bomb itself. I could even do things like redirect missiles against your own aircraft.
Say, is it my imagination or, you know, I'm developing a reputation for creating a little on-air contest of which is the less discreet, my question or the answer I'm trying to get out of the guest. But you're not going to tell me who you think is doing this, are you?
Well,
and it's okay if you don't. It really is. There's no point in letting a cat out of the bag that needs to stay in the bag. I'm okay with that. Let's stuff a politician into it and toss them both into a river, a crooked politician.
The problem with this is that, well, you know, the actual source of this may not even be within our own books, so to speak.
Gotcha.
Keep in mind, a lot of the information warfare assets that have been utilized over the past couple of years have actually been criminal elements who use it to penetrate banks and then occasionally get very patriotic for a fee.
Sure.
And, you know, do things for fun. The Georgian war is a perfect example with the Russians. The Russian mafia helped out an awful lot. They penetrated the Georgian internet sites. They actually used Twitter and Facebook to coordinate their attacks. you know, it was not only innovative, it was extremely entertaining to watch. It was also somewhat eye-opening because, you know, these weren't even, you know, official, quote-unquote, Russian military people. These were the unofficial folks. So the actual location or development of a lot of this stuff may be unknown. My best guess, like I said, I believe is Big Safari. I think they actually originated this because they were the first ones to get a hold of an AESA back in the late 1990s. And suddenly we started hearing about, all the car alarms going off outside of an Air Force base in Florida.
Oh, there you go.
Oops.
Let me ask you a question. What do you, I just got an email here from a fella, and he wanted to know what about electronic voting machines? Could somebody wax kind of patriotic and crack into one of those? Are those electronic voting machines secure, just in your opinion?
They are not very secure. Diebold is one of the biggest producers of electronic voting machines. Diebold, of course, you know, also does ATMs for banks.
Right.
And I found it very interesting when I was reading a lot of Diebold's information that they oppose actually doing setting up audit streams and printed receipts of the voting that takes place simply because it was, quote, too expensive. Yet, you know, I go over to my ATM and pull out $10, I get a little printed ticket that shows that I pulled out $10 and exactly when. And, you know, there's a camera there photographing me. So, yeah, that's just the starting edge. Yeah, it is possible to hack into these things. It has happened. You know, there have been circumstances here in the U.S. when polling has taken place on the electronic machines that the number of voters that voted far exceeded the population of the locality. That sort of tells you somebody was messing around or a major mistake was made. If hackers can reach in and disturb banking and financial networks, then you can guarantee that they can also reach in and disturb voting networks. And that's because a lot of the same systems are very parallel. Diebold used you never invent anything new if you can resell it under a different name. It's a lot of the same ATM software goes into the voting booth. And the only thing that they subtracted was the little printer and with the receipt. That's the thing that always bothered me is that, why would you oppose, the actual audit and printing of receipts with a vote? But it's A-okay if I, use my ATM card at Walmart to buy a 25-cent stick of gum, I get a receipt.
Well, how much of this, like I say, your bona fides are so good. I mean, I'm just tempted to throw all sorts of stuff out there that maybe the information has a practical application for listeners at large, and certainly for me, because I'm no authority on any aspect of your field. But you're talking about some of this stuff being orchestrated on Facebook. I find it very difficult to believe that the entire Arab Spring was orchestrated over social networking. Is this even possible?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, if it is, then...
Keep in mind, we've even seen this degenerate into criminal elements. You flash mobs?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, a flash mob dance. Well, one of the latest gigs has been flash crimes, where...
Flash mob robberies, you're right.
Okay, so... We've seen this being adopted and being used. Now, granted, it may seem very unlikely. It is quite possible and has been monitored, like in the case of the Russians and the Arabs, that have used Twitter and Facebook to organize, to recruit, to communicate, and to essentially set up operations. One of the big advantages there is you're not broadcasting, you're running it over the internet. So, the Israeli Air Force got very, very good at cell phone hacking. Well, you know, one of the counters was Hezbollah switched over and started using Facebook and Twitter and voice over internet, VOIP, so they wouldn't have those problems. And it became very difficult for the Israelis to follow last go around. And the reason for that was because there were no emissions for them to track and home in on. That's the reason why we're starting to see some counter efforts being instituted at the manufacturing side. I especially love the installation of GPS into cell phones and other devices, wireless devices, where, you know, even if it's off in your pocket, it's still being tracked.
Yeah, I understand the only way to shut off a cell phone to where it can't actually be turned on into a listening device, even when it's off, is to turn it off and remove the battery. Do you find that to be the
case?
Okay.
That is absolutely correct. And believe me, anybody who looks at you straight in the face, politician or otherwise, and says law enforcement will never use this, it's too late. They've already used it, and they will continue to use it. In many cases, they're using it without warrant to just go ahead and track whoever they want to. Now, that's Big Brother's aspect. As the technology merges out into the field, you'll begin to find independents utilizing the same thing, stalkers following their targets, robbers and others being able to monitor these kinds of things. We have also seen that again at the other end of this, where, you know, typical American idiots post, I'm going on vacation tomorrow, or I'm on vacation right now, you know, Twittering and Facebooking, and their exact address and location is available. And we have criminals who are going, okay, I'm going to go over to your house and rob it because I know you're not there. So innovation always is the key, especially when it comes to financial and or political or economic gain. It is a war, and believe me, the merger, especially onto the internet, has been extremely monitored by our folks at Fort Meade, Maryland. They've installed major computer and satellite systems in association with the NRO to try to pick up every little bit, every little scrap they can. And unfortunately, the processing for them is too slow to still deliver it in a real-time basis unless you focused in on a specific subject or target. But it is, you know, within the realm of those of us who know to, say, trigger that network by utilizing certain code words, even over the regular telephone or through your internet communications or your cell phone. I can guarantee that if you use something like Big Safari, U235, VX, you're going to be setting off all sorts of alarms in about 20 different programs, and they're just going to be, oh, who is this guy and what does he know?
Very interesting. When we come back, we're going to talk with Charles Smith some more about, is it really true that the technological capability is 30 years out from what we think is current? And how is that being applied to us now? Thanks for coming aboard the mothership. John Wells in with you tonight. This is Coast to Coast AM, and we shall return.